This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. Foreign ministers from China and Iran, which are both subject to U.S. sanctions, signed a landmark 25-year cooperation agreement on Saturday. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi was quoted by Iran's state media as telling his Iranian counterpart Mohammad Zarif the following: "Relations between the two countries have now reached a level of strategic partnership, and China seeks to comprehensively improve relations with Iran." Security forces killed more than 90 people across Myanmar on Saturday in one of the bloodiest days of protests since a military coup last month. This is according to news reports and witnesses. The lethal crackdown came on Armed Forces Day. The senior general, who is the junta leader, said during a parade to mark the event that the military would protect the people and strive for democracy. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson strongly criticized on Saturday what he called disgraceful acts on police officers after protesters in Bristol, Western England, against a new policing bill turned violent and resulted in 10 arrests. Local police said a demonstration involving more than 1,000 people on Friday afternoon had been largely peaceful, but a minority had shown hostility to police later in the evening. Prime Minister Johnson also said Saturday that he saw nothing in the COVID-19 data to change his plans for a piecemeal easing of lockdown in England, with the next major steps due to take place next month. Mr. Johnson said he looked forward to getting his haircut and having a pint of beer in the garden of a pub among the activities permitted if stage two of his lockdown plan proceeds on April 12th. This is VOA News. Thousands of Bhutanese traveled to schools and public buildings for vaccination on Saturday as the Himalayan Kingdom launched its biggest inoculation drive against COVID-19 with the AstraZeneca shots provided by India. A giant container ship grounded in the Suez Canal could be freed by the start of next week if heavier tugboats, dredging, and a high tide succeed in dislodging it. This is according to a Dutch firm working to free the vessel. The 400-meter-long Ever Given became wedged diagonally across a southern section of the canal amid high winds early on Tuesday, disrupting global shipping by blocking one of the world's busiest waterways. Belarus authorities warned on Saturday that anyone participating in protests is liable to criminal prosecution as armored vehicles and police buses moved into the center of the capital Minsk ahead of an expected new round of protests. Opposition figures have led demonstrations against President Alexander Lukashenko since an election they deemed rigged in August of last year, and they have recently called on the public to ramp up protests once again after a two-month lull. Voting began in Assam and West Bengal on Saturday in state elections that will show how support for Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi is holding up following a coronavirus-stricken year and months of protests by farmers against his agricultural reforms. Modi was reelected for a second five-year term in 2019, and his grip on power is under no threat, but the elections in the two eastern states are the first since the farmers launched protests that have been mainly in the north around the capital, Delhi. Five people were killed and 24 injured when a Cairo apartment building collapsed in the early hours of Saturday, the Egyptian state news agency reported. Witnesses told Reuters that many people were still trapped under the rubble of the 10-story building. And hundreds of people demonstrated outside a key mosque in the Bangladesh capital Saturday as the country braces for violence a day after deadly protests by hardline Islamists against a visit by Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. The clashes, which began Friday at the main mosque in the capital Dhaka, spread to several key districts in the Muslim-majority nation of 168 million, leaving five people dead and scores injured. Via remote, Laurel Bowman for VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
So if the Minister of Information is saying that Nigeria will begin to see when the Go administration has done 6 years out of 2 terms of 8 years, when will Nigerians begin to see an improvement in the collateral corruption that is happening under its administration?
The Nigerian government implements new measures to curb corruption. We'll have a reaction.
We have a code on the ECZ to be effective in terms of bringing to task those political institutions or personalities that go against the agreed code of conduct.
The Catholic Church hierarchy in Zambia directs priests to decline offers of government funds ahead of the upcoming August elections.
If Mama Samia wants to start afresh, she has to allow the parties to work, parties to grow, parties to meet society, parties to talk, and leaders not to be harassed.
And Tanzania buries former President John Magufuli Friday. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Nigerian government is implementing reforms that will encourage transparency and make it easier to conduct business in the West African country. Responding to media inquiries, Information Minister Lai Mohammed says the administration has also strengthened anti-corruption efforts to clean up all sectors of the economy where allegations of graft have been made. With time, he adds, Nigerians will see the positive effects of the measures being implemented to combat graft. His remarks come after critics accused the government of not doing enough to curb corruption. They cited recent low ratings contained in Transparency International's latest report on investor perceptions of corruption in Nigeria. But Mohammed says the reports are not an accurate reflection of the situation on the ground. He adds that data used by the Transparency International for its findings were inconsistent and inadequate. Kola Ologbodiyan is the spokesperson for Nigeria's main opposition People's Democratic Party, or PDP. He tells me that the government appears unable to effectively combat corruption.
You can imagine a government under whose administration a kilometer of road is to cost 2.12 billion. There's nowhere in the whole wide world where a kilometer of road will cost that much. As we speak, Nigerians are agitating against the proposed renovation of the Port Harcourt refinery at a huge and humongous cost of $1.5 billion. In history of this country, we have witnessed a situation where the government said it is planning Air Nigeria, and the cost of the logo alone, the cost of the logo was $2 billion. Wherever you look at in the ministries, departments, and agencies under this Buhari administration, corruption is a heavy load being carried by our nation.
Bakola, Information Minister Lai Mohammed is saying the administration is implementing new measures to stop acts of public corruption. He cited instances like the power sector, where new measures have been implemented to ensure corruption is fought aggressively. How do you react to that?
There is nowhere under President Muhammadu Buhari administration where corruption is being fought. Fighting corruption under this government has become a tool against opposition and perceived enemies of the government. In the history of this administration, 6 years almost down the line, there is no official of this administration that has been put up on corruption charges. Not because there are no corruption cases, but because they enjoy the cover of the Buhari presidency. And it is therefore laughable that the Minister of Information will come up at any fora to make a declaration that the government or this administration is fighting corruption, where all the investigation carried out by the parliament, and I mean the National Assembly, none has been implemented. All the cases of corruption that have been discovered, even some DGs, director generals of agencies, were freed with their loot. So it is strange to the average Nigerian on the street there for the minister to claim that this administration is fighting corruption. This administration is the worst in the history of our country in the area of corruption. It is totally corrupt.
But supporters of the president saying he still remains incorruptible and that these are just mere allegations being perpetrated by opponents of the administration, including the PDP, just to tarnish the reputation of the president and by extension members of his administration.
Are the supporters of President Muhammad Buhari claiming that the first lady, Aisha Buhari, who alleged that 500 billion meant for social incentives for Nigerians was stolen under President Muhammadu Buhari? Is she an enemy of President Buhari? The truth of the matter is that corruption under this government can be held. It's palpable. It can be felt, not just by the elites, but by the ordinary people on the streets of Nigerians. It is therefore a cover-up for any official of government to claim that, oh, it's only the enemies of the government that are making allegations of corruption against this administration. It is out of place and totally so for anybody to say that, oh, President Muhammadu Buhari is not corrupt. But his administration is perceptibly corrupt. It's a matter of fact, it's on the streets.
The information minister is of the view that because of the new measures they've put in place, the Transparency International latest report did not capture it, and that Nigerians will soon see the effectiveness of the new measures that the administration has implemented. What do you say to that?
Well, that's also a laughable assertion, because even today, the People's Democratic Party has consistently demanded that the APC administration should account for 15 trillion allegedly stolen by APC leaders. And no effort has been made to provide any form of explanation in that direction. So if the Minister of Information is saying that Nigeria will begin to see when the administration has done 6 years out of 2 terms of 8 years, when will Nigerians begin to see an improvement in the collateral corruption that is happening under its administration?
Kola Ologbodiyan is the spokesperson for Nigeria's main opposition People's Democratic Party, or PDP. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. In Zambia, Catholic priests are being urged to decline offers of empowerment funds from the government in the run-up to the August 12 general election. But the directive from the church hierarchy is generating criticism from supporters of the government. They say the order appears to be politically motivated and seems to indicate tacit support for the opposition ahead of the polls. But some parishioners and civil society groups welcome the directive. They say it will prevent the appearance of undue government influence on the church before the elections. Meanwhile, three church groups are calling on the Electoral Commission to ensure this year's polls are transparent and credible. For the latest development about the directive to the clergy, I reach Father Cleophas Lungu, Secretary General of the Zambia Conference of Catholic Bishops.
The Catholic bishops took the position that they were going to decline receiving these funds or accessing these funds. And the guidance they have given to government is that they would prefer that these funds or are channeled to other greater needy areas of the country. In addition, the Catholic bishops have also guided the clergy. We are talking of priests and other church leaders in Zambia under the auspices of the Catholic Church that being an election year, it would be prudent for them to be very cautious in receiving any form of donation from politicians, especially when they come and they want to address the congregation during the Eucharistic celebrations or worship. The consistent position of the Catholic bishops in Zambia is that the church is non-partisan.
But Father Lungu, some Zambians that I spoke with are worried that an empowerment fund could be misconstrued as an influencer for the Catholic Church against the government, because they said Zambia is a Christian nation and the Catholic Church has deep roots in doing good in the socio-economic activities that benefit all Zambians. So declining the funds or misconstruing it to be an influencer ahead of the elections is misplaced. How do you respond to that?
The Catholic Church in Zambia is of the considered view that if ever government wants to reach out to the people, especially those who are poor and vulnerable, there are sufficient channels of delivering, you know, assistance to those people. We believe that just as much as those people would be saying the position taken by the church would be understood as an influence against the ruling party. On the other hand, there are many people who would also see the church receiving donations as an influencer in terms of the Catholic Church endorsing the same party which is in power. As I already said, the church is non-partisan, and the position has been taken in order to highlight its non-partisan position or policy. But we are not against programs of empowerment, but we are questioning the priority considerations on the side of government. There are many other areas where they could channel this money. And at the same time, we believe the timing of it is not right. And the Catholic Church in Zambia will remain nonpartisan. That must be underlined.
Well, Father Lungu, the three church mother bodies came out recently issuing a statement cautioning the Electoral Commission about going about its business to ensure this upcoming elections are free, transparent, and credible. Talk to me about this latest call from the three main church mother bodies about the upcoming elections.
Yes, indeed. The three church mother bodies, that includes the Council of Churches in Zambia, CCZ, the Evangelical Fellowship of Zambia, EFZ, the Zambia Conference of Catholic Bishops, ZCCB, has issued a statement in which they are calling on the Electoral Commission of Zambia to ensure that the environment in the country before, during, and after the elections is conducive, in terms of having free, fair, peaceful, and credible elections. We know that this electoral management body has an enormous task to ensure that all stakeholders play according to the rules of the game in terms of the legislative jurisdiction in the country. We have the electoral code of conduct that must be adhered to in terms of maintaining rule of law, maintaining peace and order, even during the political campaigns. And we have called on the ECZ to be effective in terms of bringing to task those political institutions or personalities that go against the agreed code of conduct.
Father Cleophas Lungu is the Secretary General of the Zambia Conference of Catholic Bishops. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. Tanzanians buried former President John Magufuli at his family home in Chato in the country's northwestern district Friday. The ceremony, which was broadcast live on television and other media platforms, was attended by newly installed President Samia Suluhu Hassan, senior government officials and opposition leaders. The former president, who died last week, becomes the only sitting head of state to die while in office since the country gained independence from Britain in 1961. For the latest development in Tanzania, I reached political analyst Sami Ruhuza in the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam.
As a human being, everyone is sad. And we pray to God so that he rests in peace. And now as Tanzanians, all eyes are on Mama Samia Suluhu Hassan, who is now the president of Tanzania. And we hope he will do better, as she may correct all the mistakes done by John Magufuli. So we hope all the best from her.
Well, Sami, so far, how are Tanzanians reacting, particularly for those in his hometown who witnessed the entire event?
Yeah, it was shown live on TV, but and very few attended the ceremony. But the elders of Chato requested the new president now to fulfill the promise of the late Magufuli to make Chato the region. He promised Chato people that Chato will become a region or a city, I can say. So the current president, Mama Samia Suluhu, has shown interest on making it up. So I think very soon it will be the region and not district. And there's a lot of investments in Chato. Magufuli tried his best to build Chato to make it a commercial area, I can say. And I guess it won't be a white elephant. And Mama Samia promised them. So I think they're all okay.
You stated that all eyes are on Mama Samia, the new president. What are the expectations of her? What do Tanzanians expect her to do after taking over?
Today, actually from the day at Uhuru Stadium, Dar es Salaam, the opposition parties participated in the ceremony. Dodoma, they participated. Chato today, they participated. The opposition party leaders, but they were not recognized. So I don't know, and I don't think, if Mama Samia will do different to what Magufuli did to these political parties. I don't know. Maybe she will, but I don't think so. Because the president is an institution.
Well, Sami, can that be attributed to a mere oversight?
It's not an oversight. Because they are there, and they went there. I don't think so. But anyway, as long as someone is dead, you cannot say bad about him. It's gone, and there's no way back. And now we are looking forward to see how Mama Samia will do her work. But I think the first step is to unite the nation.
But Magufuli was president for all Tanzanians, in spite of the sharp differences of opinions he had with the opposition. So some Tanzanians say they expected the opposition leaders to be there anyway. But do you expect more political space in Tanzania following the new leadership, or more engagement with the opposition and other stakeholders who might have a different political view?
If Mama Samia wants to start afresh, she has to allow the parties to work, parties to grow, parties to meet society, parties to talk, and leaders not to be harassed. When you give the different opinion, then you are on fire. So if she wants, that's why I say she must work on unity to unite the nation. If the nation is united and people are free to talk, press are free to write, to broadcast, and everyone is free to tell a leader that you are wrong, this is not what you're supposed to do, then things will change automatically.
Sami Ruhuza is a Tanzanian political analyst. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. Egypt's Suez Canal Authority is trying again for a third day to refloat a giant container ship that is blocking traffic in the main artery of the canal and disrupting world trade, which passes through the strategic waterway. For VOA, Edward Iranian reports from the Egyptian capital, Cairo.
Egyptian media is reporting that several hundred ships are now blocked on both sides of the Suez Canal as frantic efforts continue to try to refloat a gigantic container ship, the Ever Given, which has been wedged in a main canal artery since Tuesday. Egyptian media claims that up to 87% of the dredging work necessary to free the ship has already been performed and that it should take a couple more days to a week at most to get international traffic moving in the Suez Canal once again. Around 50 ships a day normally pass through the canal, and around 200 ships are now stranded at various points along the canal's trajectory since it became blocked Tuesday afternoon. Saeed Sadiq, who is an Egyptian political sociologist, tells VOA that there has been a great deal of bluster about the closure of the canal and talk about having international shipping go around southern Africa's Cape of Good Hope instead. Most of the talk, he argues, is not logical.
Without the corona, maybe it would have been attracting some attention, but not with the same concern that it is doing today. It has to do with the international economy and worry and the new alliances in the Middle East, what is happening.
Sadiq references media reports about building a new overland route between the United Arab Emirates and Israel for oil and gas shipments from the Gulf. He says he doubts that such a route is likely to be built anytime soon and insists the Suez Canal is much cheaper than other possible routes. The Associated Press, however, reported that some ships are being rerouted to avoid going through the Suez Canal. AP reports that the liquid natural gas carrier Pan Americas was apparently diverted in the mid-Atlantic to the Southern Africa route along the Cape of Good Hope. A sister ship to the Ever Given, the Ever Greet, was also reportedly diverted to the Southern Africa route. There may, however, be some concern that Egypt could seize the second ship in compensation for damages over the canal closure that may have prompted the move. Sadiq says various conspiracy theories are floating around on social media about sabotage to the ship, but that it is most likely an act of God, given the sandstorm that was taking place when the accident occurred, and there is no proof of any sabotage.
There was this fear about if this is part of a conspiracy to close or end the Suez Canal. This is, again, exaggerated, because this is an incident that will be resolved soon. When? It can be a few days or a week maximum, but it is not really the end of the Suez Canal.
European media reported that the Ever Given, which is blocking the canal, may have incurred structural damage after hitting a ferry near the port of Hamburg in 2019. Egyptian authorities are also worried that the longer the ship remains wedged, the higher the chances that it incurs further damage. The Ever Given is 400 meters long, which is longer than the width of the canal at the point where the ship is wedged, and it has around 20,000 containers on board, which could cause it to sag and damage its infrastructure. Sadiq notes that shipping insurance companies like Lloyd's of London would be responsible for damages incurred by both Egypt and the Japanese owner of the ship if it was determined that the accident was caused by an act of God rather than human negligence. Egypt earns between $5 billion and $6 billion each year in revenues from the Suez Canal. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, in Uganda, civil society groups are calling on the government to stop what they say are the arbitrary arrests of opposition supporters. At a recent press conference, leaders of the groups demanded the immediate release of the arrested partisans. They said it is unacceptable for the authorities to jail perceived political opponents of the administration. Their remarks come after the opposition National Unity Platform, or NUP, accused state security operatives, including the police, of arresting their supporters and beating them up. This following the conclusion of the recent presidential and parliamentary elections. But supporters of the government deny the accusations. They are calling on the police to arrest and prosecute those responsible for causing chaos and tension in the country. To learn more about the calls by civil society groups, I reach Goodbear Tumushabe, head of the Great Lakes Institute for Strategic Studies.
Over the last couple of months, we've had a number of people killed. Close to 3,000 people are estimated to have been either kidnapped or arrested illegally, and over 300 people missing. They were arrested by vehicles called drones, normally driven by the military or security officials. These vehicles normally come, especially at night. So as civil society, we are calling upon the president and the government to say we cannot live in a country where citizens can simply disappear and there is no accountability. So we are demanding for their release and full accountability of what has happened.
What do you say to supporters of the government who are denying that there are ongoing kidnappings or arrests of supporters of the opposition party, the National Unity Platform?
All regimes that have stayed in power for as long as the one that we have in Uganda, which has been in power for 35 years and counting, they behave exactly the same way, that government spokespersons will always come and tell a different narrative of what's happening. We just recently had a situation where President Museveni came on live TV and openly, with a straight face, that Bobi Wine stole his votes or stole elections. And remember that he is the president. He's the appointing authority for the Electoral Commission. And therefore, if he has any evidence that Bobi Wine or any other person stole his votes, he has the full authority of the executive to bring a case before the court. But we've also had situations where the Minister for Internal Affairs has appeared in Parliament and reported that actually they have people who are missing whom they cannot account for. So at this moment, there is no shadow of doubt. Definitely, there are people who cannot be accounted for.
So, Godbear, what is the next line of action for civil society groups, apart from calling for an end to these alleged kidnappings or arrests, as you previously described?
So, as civil society, we have essentially laid out a very, very elaborate strategy to deal with this situation, because we cannot let it survive and thrive in our country. Quite a number of things are fairly classified, so I may not be able to discuss them on air. But I can tell you, Peter, that one, we have decided that we are going to use every judicial mechanism available, whether it is the Ugandan judicial system, whether it is the East African Court of Justice or the African Court of Justice. We are going to use all these mechanisms to challenge the actions of the regime, because we think they are illegal, they are unconstitutional, and they go against the spirit and the letter of the African Union and its charter on democracy and elections, as well as the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. Secondly, we have also agreed that we are going to systematically and consistently engage a number of offices or institutions and actors here in Uganda and elsewhere. We are currently working on a petition to the Speaker of Parliament. We think that the Parliament is not doing enough. They are just basically making muted voices of disapproval. They haven't been aggressive enough in demanding for action from the executive. So we are going to be petitioning the Speaker of the Ugandan Parliament, demanding that herself or her deputy and the full parliament take action. We are planning to write to the chairman of the East African community, President Uhuru Kenyatta of Kenya, and demand that the East African community cannot remain silent in the face of the kinds of violations of human rights in Uganda, which are clearly inconsistent with the provisions of the East African Community Treaty. But we're also planning to write to and engage with the chairman of the African Union, President Tshisekedi of DRC, because we think that the African Union is conspicuously silent on violations of human rights and citizens' rights that are taking place in Uganda, and yet the African Union has been very clear in demanding that member states respect minimum standards with regard to both elections, but also with regard to respect for human rights.
Well, Godbe, this is not the first time that civil society and or opposition groups have called for things to be done differently or demanded for change. What do you think is different this time?
As long as the citizens of Uganda are challenging the actions of the regime, including the work that we are doing in civil society to demand and the release of these young people who have been arrested, and demand that those who are considered to have committed offenses are produced in courts of law, as long as the international community does not give tacit approval to the actions of the regime, I can tell you that this is different, and I can see that the end is in sight as far as changing the current trajectory of the dictatorship and the abuse of human rights is concerned, and it can only be a matter of time.
Godbe Tumushabe is the head of the Great Lakes Institute for Strategic Studies. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Kenya has reintroduced restrictive measures to combat the spread of the coronavirus in the country. Kenya has locked down the capital and surrounding counties. The country's positive rate this week stood at 22%, a 20% increase in just under 2 months. For VOA, Mohamed Yusuf reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
Addressing the nation Friday, Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta put the capital, Nairobi, and surrounding counties under lockdown.
But fully conscious that 70% of Kenya's reported cases of COVID-19 have been recorded in the counties of Nairobi, Kajiado, Machakos, Kiambu, and Nakuru, these counties are individually and collectively declared a disease-infected area. That there shall be a cessation of all movement by road, rail, or air into and out of the disease-infected area as one zoned area.
Recent COVID-19 testing measures the positivity rate at 22%, a 20% jump from January. Nairobi is leading with 6 in 10 people testing positive. 32-year-old Obadiah Langat, a Nairobi resident, is rushing home after attending a burial. He is in a rush to beat a nighttime curfew.
We are traveling for a burial more than 20 kilometers out of Eldoret. Now we are entering Eldoret. We don't know how, because we don't know how we are going to make it to Nairobi. So it's sad for us. It's shocking.
Kenyatta explains why it is necessary to control the movement of people in and out of 5 counties.
If you test 100 Kenyans for COVID, 20 will be positive. This compared to January this year, when only 2 would have been positive. And this tells us that our rate of infection has gone up 10 times between January and March of 2021.
Kenya has also banned public gatherings, reduced curfew hours, people eating restaurants, and ordered bars to be closed. Simon Njoroge is the chairman of the Kenya Bars and Hotels Association, and he says only vaccination can save them from frequent shutdowns.
We don't want to comment so much on the directives of today, because we have to sit down and go back to the drawing board. But as a chair, I would like to tell the government that, yes, there is corona, there is COVID-19, and the directives have been followed. But I wish the government would have come forward and give vaccination to our staff guys, to our people.
In early March, Kenya received 1.1 million vaccine doses. About 50,000 people have received the jabs. Kenya has recorded 125,000 coronavirus cases and 2,100 deaths. Authorities say the latest measures will remain until further notice. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The World Food Programme warns of severe food shortages and rising hunger in Angola as the country is gripped by its worst drought in nearly four decades. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Angola's rainy season, which normally runs from November to April, is delivering a trickle of the rainfall needed to grow a good crop and raise healthy livestock. The abnormal dryness is adversely affecting the lives and livelihoods of millions of people in the country's southwestern provinces. World Vision Australia says 11 million people, half of them children, are affected by the high price of food and rising hunger. The World Food Programme says conditions are not expected to improve in the coming months because of the below-average rainfall. WFP spokesman Thompson Feary says Angola's diminishing water supply is having a severe impact on crops, with losses of up to 40%. In addition, he says lack of grazing land risks decimating people's livestock.
WFP is extremely concerned given the chronic food insecurity and malnutrition rates in the west affected areas. The situation is also reportedly giving rise to migratory movements, with families moving towards other provinces and across the border into Namibia.
The UN Children's Fund says Angola has one of the highest infant mortality rates in the world, with nearly 75 deaths per 1,000 live births. There's also a great disparity in the mineral-rich African nation, with some people extremely wealthy and others living in a state of poverty. The United Nations says 40% of the Angolan population lives below the poverty line. Because Angola is moving toward being classified as a middle-income country, the World Food Programme does not provide food aid to the hungry. Thierry says the government is able to take care of its own people. However, he adds WFP provides technical assistance and expertise to improve conditions for the needy. For instance, he says WFP currently is helping the government expand its school feeding programs, particularly in the south and southwest. It also is involved in malnutrition response, which is a chronic problem in the country. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Are you nice? Baby. Shauru taki kabisa. Eti unache na visa ya fira mina musiki. Ikilala na utakama na niita. Nafumba macho na vuta shuka. Naona na pumba zika. Unishika kwa ndipo hapo na farigika. Mambo yako mahaba yako. No mana na tonu no kawe. Kapona rapi ameni banusura jeuri sina tena wendo ganzi meni maliza hasira si huyo akisema nidekeze nielewa
Nitambulishe nitambe ni wavibie.
She's so insecure, she don't make love with the lights on. So insecure, she don't wanna talk about it, no. And I'm so insecure, one day she leaves me and she find another guy who make her happier than I. I'm so insecure, I'm never telling you about it, yeah. Ooh, and I swim on a t-shirt, and you never leave your house with no makeup on. But let's not talk about it. And burn, hope we see the light.
You're insecure. do anything for your love.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoy it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Bill Eagle, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a young crocodile does not cry when it falls in the water. I'm your host, Peter Clotet, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.